The biggest problem in this industry is the gurus. Some of them pushed people who didn't have never picked a hammer. They never rented. They never had any experience. All they did is paid somebody $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, spent 6 months and bought a deal. Some of them who didn't have much knowledge and experience about these loan situations or managing, doing asset managements. I think some of those assets are in trouble.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of chatting with KK Singh. Now, KK is an experienced Microsoft certified system engineer. He's a successful entrepreneur and he owns multiple businesses with a proven track record of building and managing diverse portfolios. He specifically owns and operates multiple gas stations, convenience stores, laundromats, a banquet hall, and he has successfully sold over 40 single family residents in North Indiana. Now, in addition to all of that, KK holds significant investments as a limited partner in over 5,000 units and a general partner in over 2,600 units across seven properties in four different states. And he's really focusing on multifamily syndicated deals in various locations across the US. So I'm really pumped and excited to have him on the show. But enough out of me. Let's get him out here. G'day, KK. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Reid. It's my pleasure.
It's great to connect. I've known of you for a little while now. I get your emails. I love what you're doing. And then we were able to connect a couple of weeks back talking maybe potentially about partnering up. And an interesting conversation came from that around your background, which I didn't know. We'll get into that. But also how you see the market today. So today's conversation is going to be a lot about KK's Coming to America story, and I'll let you explain that. But also around the businesses that you've created in your backyard. And I think that's really cool. The Cody Sanchez's of the world are really popping right now, buying these laundromats, buying these gas stations, buying these banquet halls. You've already been there. You've already done that, these sort of blue collar, ugly businesses. But then you're also focused on multifamily. We can talk a little bit about how you see the market today. But before we dive into that, do you want to rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid?
Well, when I was in India, I started a small business. And it's going to be weird to tell you here. So there was a drought in one of the states, and we had in our state, we are an agriculture state of Punjab. It's a state north in North India. So we had a lot of sugar cane. So I saw a lot of trucks going on the roads, and I started inquiring about why they're taking those. So I started taking our sugar cane to that state for the cows. So that's how I made my first dollar. And then we started, when we learned the whole process, where to get the permits, how to take them, how to hire a truck and all that. And then we started buying from other people and taking that sugar cane to the other state where there was a drought.
Gotcha. And the sugar cane was to feed the cows?
Feed the cows, yes. And because there was nothing left in that state to feed the cows because of the drought.
Gotcha. I know also molasses is derived from sugar cane, correct?
Sugar cane is something that you can carry over 3 days, but other type of grass won't be able to take it for 3-4 days. It will decay.
Very, very interesting. Now let's bring us around to your Coming to America story. You know, you live in Indiana, Indianapolis. It's a far way from home. And as an outsider, as an expat myself, I wouldn't think Indianapolis would be on the map for immigrating from India. But tell us about that story.
Well, I had a business. I have a travel advisor business in India. A lot of people from our state are in foreign countries, but they didn't know much English because all the communication was in English. So I had an immigration consultancy service in India. So I came to, I have traveled all over the world, but I came to United States in 97 for the first time. And at that time, I realized that there is a lot of now hiring signs all over the country. I went to California, I went to Kansas, I went to New York, came to Indiana. So I went around the country in a month, and also Chicago. So I realized that there is a lot of demand for computer professionals. So I went back to school to do the Microsoft certification. And I visited one time again by myself in 1999. And then I decided to come here finally on a H-1 visa.
Gotcha. And what was the attraction to Indianapolis?
Well, I had friends in Indianapolis. So I had somebody to go to. I had my family. I had three kids with me. So I wanted where I might feel comfortable and they would help me with settling down.
It's always when you come to a new country as an expat, you want to be surrounded by, you know, people who talk and, you know, have the same ideology and that, like, I know I hang around some other Australians here in Los Angeles, right? Like, it's you know, you yearn of home sometimes, and I'm sure the same in the Indian Correct. Community as well. You know, you band together and reminisce and have great food and all that sort of good stuff and culture and, you know, crack jokes about certain things. So, yeah, so with that being said, in the introduction, I mentioned a wide range of businesses that you've had started. Where does that come from?
My friends who I came to after 9/11, I lost my job. And it was just 6 months I had come. I brought all my money that I had in India, and I was thinking of going back, but one of my friends offered me a partnership in his gas station. So he gave me a 30% partnership in the gas station, and I managed the gas station for him. And after about 6 months again, that lease expired and the owner did not renew the lease. So I was stuck again with nothing to do. But I had some experience in the gas station business for 6 to 8 months. Then, and I also had some money that I had earned over the year. So I came and I came to Fort Wayne and bought a gas station here in a partnership with my cousin. That's how I got into the gas station business. And then I brought some other friends, family, my nephew brought into the gas station business, and we grew from there. And from that gas station, we grew to 8 gas stations. Until 2010, we had 8 gas stations in about 9-10 years. And after that, I decided to build a laundromat because there was a lot sitting empty for years by my gas station. So I started doing the research on that and built a laundromat from ground up.
Gotcha. Talk to me a little bit about the gas station business. You know, it's everyone drives past it, everyone uses it. Haven't really spoken to anyone on this podcast in a decade of this podcast being going about the gas station business. You know, is it profitable in actually selling the gas, or is it more in that you make your money from selling the, you know, the confectionery and the sodas and the candies and all that sort of stuff?
So first of all, when you buy a gas station, either you can buy the real estate and the business, or you can lease the business, leave alone the real estate, you can pay rent. That's how we started. We just bought the business and still lease the real estate, which I later bought from the owner. But there are two ways. There are no calculators to see, project your profits, etc. It's just common sense and also knowledge from other people who own it, how much you need to run it. There are some minimum expenses. So it ranges from 18 to 20,000 just to manage a gas station.
Is that per month?
Per month.
Okay. Yep.
And then answer to your second question, until COVID, we didn't make money on gas or very little money on gas. We always made money in the inside stores. And the gas was to bring the customers into the store.
Mm.
So, but after 2020, things changed. The actually the street is the street other gas station is the way we manage the gas prices. So if the your competitive down the street lower the price, you'll have to lower the price. Doesn't matter whether you're losing money or you're making some money on the gas. But after 2020, things have changed and we have started making money on the gas as well.
Gotcha. What sort of, just ballpark, like you mentioned 18,000, 20,000 bucks a month of the revenue is your, you know, quote unquote, the inside, the lottery tickets, the cigarettes, the Coke, all that sort of crap. You know, is that what, 80% of the revenue?
No, it's not the percentage of the revenue, because with the gas, that it, like now the gas is around 350 here in Indiana. So the revenue will be a lot and your profit will be very little. So it's right. it's not the percentage, it's the per cents per gallon profit.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So you cannot say, okay, this is 20% of the profit, but it's normally when we calculate the profits, we calculate like 27% is the national average of the inside sales and 5 cents on the gallon. So when we calculate, when we go to buy a gas station, we calculate this way to give. But after buying so many gas stations, I have bought some for my relatives who moved from Canada and other states here. So I have brought a lot of friends here because I was the first Indian to buy a gas station here. So there weren't too many people. So, but over the years, I can look at the dumpster and tell you what should be the price of the gas station.
And I assume, like, because I know, because you go to different gas stations, were there like a, you know, multifamily Class A, Class B, Class C, Class D type of gas stations? And what type of gas stations were you buying?
Initially, we bought this gas station was in low income neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So the low income neighborhood are the best ones. They're risky. Not everybody wants those and those kind of neighborhoods, but you make more money as compared to the gas station in a nicer neighborhood, because everybody is paying by, at that time, I'm talking about 25 years ago, not a lot of people had credit cards. These days, everybody is buying gas with the credit cards. Everybody is using, buying cigarettes, et cetera, or the other merchandise with the credit card as well. So there is a lot of credit card fee involved. But at that time, we didn't have too many credit cards, et cetera. So the lower income neighborhoods were the best, not the war zones. We had a gas station in Indianapolis. Now I'm in Fort Wayne. So the first gas station that I got 30% in 6 months, we were robbed 5 times. So we had to hire a security guard. So it depends. How more the risk, more is the profit.
Right.
I'll leave it there.
Yeah, no, that's that. I get it. What, and today you're not buying any more gas stations, correct? Obviously, we'll get into what you're focused on, but you're not acquiring any more of them.
No, I'm not, because back in 2014 we bought a portfolio of 40 single family houses, so I started managing that, and after I built that laundromat, I had more interest in laundromats than gas stations, because gas stations are more riskier and a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of stealing, etc. as well. So I decided to slow down on the gas stations. So I didn't buy any gas station after 2012. Then when I bought 40 single family houses, I got this deal at our church from somebody. He wanted to sell it to me only. So he promised to help me learn this business. And I started managing those single family myself. And at that time, I was also managing a gas station and a laundromat. And my other partners were managing others. So at that time, I decided that I'll manage it myself so that I can learn the business, because I didn't know much. Anything, I would say, anything about the rental business, because we were always in the gas station business. Even in India, I had never rented anything. So the only time when we came for the first year, we were in our apartment. So that was the only experience I had with the apartment. So he started coaching me, but he was old school. He was like 80 years old and he was old school. He was trying to do everything with pen and pencil. And I was a software professional. So I thought, okay, this is not something I would do because I have other businesses as well. I have to spend time. So I moved everything online and started managing with the help of the technology, which was a lot more easier. And I spent only 9 hours a week to manage those 40 single family.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, the big question I have for you, because we've seen a big shift in the multifamily since 2012, 2013, 2014. A lot of people have got into the space, and that's because of the Jobs Act and a lot of other things. And now with higher interest rates, people are getting hurt, and I want to hear your opinion on that. But as you look at your experience, and both of us are very familiar with running rental properties. Is there a common theme when you look at your gas stations, your laundromats, your rental properties, your multifamily? Is it just a different widget? You know, gas stations, you're selling gas and confectionery. Laundromats, you're selling, you know, cycles of laundry, you know, to the everyday folk. You know, your widget in multifamily is a roof over someone's head. And at the end of the day, you've got to have good management, good people, and be able to balance the books. I'm simplifying it, but I wanted to know your perspective of it as you've compared them over the years, looking back on do they run a similar, the skills that you developed in one can be transferred to the other two?
So the only thing that was similar in all the businesses were the same kind of people.
Mm.
So we had low-income people, neighborhood, gas station, and a laundromat. You're dealing with the same type of people. And then again, the rental that we owned were C-class. So it was a similar behavior. And also I learned over the years in being in business that you can educate them to whichever way you want. To give you an example, if they are coming to our gas station and they are trying to steal something, and that's what we started with, there were a lot of people because the guy who owned the gas station before us, he was an absentee owner and they had managers and cashiers. So everybody was stealing. And so did the customers. Because when they are stealing, they don't care about the customers. So when we came in, the customers had a hard time. And then we had a family working, my cousin and my nephew, and me, we all three were working at the gas station. We wouldn't let anything move out of the door. We controlled that and we educated them that we are not going to let you steal. So they stopped stealing and that's where the profit was. So either they left to some other gas stations where they could do the same thing. They started paying. They knew that they were looking at us. They're watching us. They will catch us. They'll call the police and all that. So the same thing when we bought this portfolio, the previous owner owned those houses for, I don't know, roughly 40 years. So they were all paid off. He didn't care much if somebody didn't pay. And he would start listening to their stories and sit there and listen to their stories. And then they will say, okay, pay me next month. I went in, we had a loan. So they tried to tell me the same stories. I said, no. I'm not here to listen stories. I'm here to collect rent. So if I listen to your story, the bank will not listen to my stories. And then you will lose the house, I will lose the property. So let's not do this. This is the way you can pay. Either you can go online and pay, or you give me a money order. I didn't even accept checks. So you can give me a money order up to the 5th. It has to be in my box if you want. If you don't want to pay me the late fee. So I had to train all my, and I went to one by one and taught them how they can pay from the phone. So it was a lot easier. More than 50% of the tenants were paying on the phone, online. I didn't even have to take those checks or money orders to the bank. So I had to educate them, train them, and they knew that there is going to be a late fee on 5th. And I would say I can't remove the late fee. So one time they paid the late fee, second time they didn't.
Yeah, gotcha. No, it's interesting that, because you would, yeah, everything from laundromats to, you know, low income housing to, you know, petrol stations. Yeah, that's the same folks who are everyday folks, blue collar people, good hardworking people. You know, similar traits can happen, right? And I think the fact that you're identifying and did identify, you know, I wouldn't say sloppiness, but maybe it was in the operations of letting people get away with it for too long that they got used to it, right? It's not whether they need to steal or they don't need to pay. It's more the fact that they got used to it. Why don't I keep doing this? It's human nature, right? It's very, very interesting because you've got such a wide breadth of knowledge across many different businesses. So let's pivot into multifamily. I mentioned earlier you're obviously you have a large LP across a lots of units. You're also a GP. How have you seen the last 5 to 10 years as an investor? And where do you see us going, you know, given the sort of higher interest rate environment that we're in today and maybe some blood in the street that you might be seeing?
So after we bought this single family, very first year, I realized that real estate doesn't help you to pay less taxes, because at that time we were paying a lot of taxes with all these businesses, gas station and laundromats. So I decided to start investing with other people. I had never thought that I'm going to be doing my own deals or being GP on these deals. So I was just investing my cash flow that we were making from the businesses into the real estate. But I learned so much over the years. So I started coaching and I started doing my own deals, raising capital for operators that I partner with. Over these years, I have seen a lot of things happen since I started in multifamily. The biggest problem, I think, in this industry is the gurus. So that pushed people who have never picked a hammer. They didn't know anything. They never rented. They never had any experience. All they did is paid somebody $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, spent 6 months and bought a deal.
Yep.
And they didn't know everything about the how to manage it. And they didn't know everything, how to get a loan, what to do, all these things. And there was the market was in a hype and everybody was making money. The investors were making money and everybody was happy and there was a party going on. So they never realized that the Fed is going to come in and start raising the interest rate, and they would raise so much in a year and a half.
Hey guys, this is a quick ad for our latest multifamily investment opportunity called the Avalon Apartments, located in Dallas, Texas, the fastest growing MSA in the nation. Now, rapid fire, here are the three reasons why we love this asset. Firstly, great investor returns of over 20% annualized. The second thing, of the 226 units, 30% have already been renovated and they're achieving a $250 rental premium. Now, our business plan is pretty simple. We'll come in and renovate the remaining 70% to achieve those proven rental levels, then rely on a modest 3% rent growth thereafter. It's very conservative, very straightforward, and the same thing we have been doing successfully for over a decade. Now, last thing, pricing for multifamily apartment properties have fallen more today than they did during the 2008 global financial crisis. This could very well be the best time in commercial real estate cycle to pick up cheap assets. If you're interested to find out more, click on the link below.
So, some of them who didn't have much knowledge and experience about these loan situations or managing, doing asset managements on the property. Some of them didn't even know they had a list of questions to ask from a property management, but they didn't know what to do it and who is a good property manager. And some of them got ripped off with the property managers as well, property management companies as well. So those, I think some of those assets are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they bought a interest cap, they bought, they had a wide range between the interest rate and the cap. So they didn't have enough cash flow. Or some people, even I know a few of them, they bought first time, they have never done anything. They were in the computer job. They bought properties like 40%, 60% occupied or heavy lifting properties. So those are the kind of guys who are in trouble. And mm-hmm. I think all others are going to manage it. Maybe they're not paying the cash flow preferred return to the investors at this time, but they will get through this time and the prices are still going up. The prices haven't gone down. I don't see any blood in the roads, but there will be some people who are going to lose properties or already lost some properties. And I know a few who didn't have any knowledge with the rentals, and they bought like six properties, and all six properties are gone back.
Yeah, well, that's the blood I'm talking about, like that. Yeah. You know, it is happening.
Yes,
is it blood? Is it blood from everyone? No, but there is blood in the street. Look, I think you make a good point there of just the experience. It has been, and I remember going to a conference cup before the pandemic, a very quite notable conference in the multifamily space, and there was hundreds of people running the hallways raising capital, and I'm a capital raiser, and it just felt. It felt really frothy, right? And obviously the combination of the stimulus, which really pushed up rents, and then people thought that they could they were selling deals at massive IRRs where they've held it for 12 months and turn around and make a 30% IRR because they did nothing because there was so much stimulus. It was a perfect storm, and then lower interest rates. People got lower interest rates, thinking they'll never go to the moon. Well, not that they've gone to the moon, but they've more than gone up 500% since early 2022. It's going to cause pain, and I think there are not only the inexperienced, but I've seen a lot of more experienced operators have some pain as well. But to your point, those more experienced operators can probably ride the ship through the stormy waters, and others may not be able to. Your average investor who you talk to, are they apprehensive about the multifamily space right now? Are they bullish on it? Like, where's their head?
So they are not. A lot of people are not bullish on it, but that doesn't mean they won't invest. So if they were investing $200,000, they might invest $100,000 or $50,000. Mm-hmm. But I still have investors that are asking me, when are we doing the next deal? Because there is still money in the market. People have money. It's just sitting on the sidelines. They want to park somewhere where they can make more money than the banks. So nowadays, even the banks, banks are giving you 5 or 6%. So when we talk about paying them 7%, they said, we are safe here in the bank rather than investing. Let's wait and see. So the problem is, when I started investing, then there was like 8% preferred return. And then the IRR was like 18 to 20%. Mm-hmm. And I have got that. We have sold several properties. Even with our co-GP partnership, we have sold two properties. So our investors made pretty good money. And we made pretty good money with other people as well where we invested. But now the prices are the same. The prices are not really going down. That neither the preferred return is going back to 8%. The IRRs, and then they started these waterfalls. And back in 2013 or 14, I started investing. So at that time, there were no waterfalls either. So now the returns, we are still sitting at the same place, whereas the market has gone down.
Well, let's clarify that for people. You're saying the returns haven't gone down, but the market has gone down, correct?
market has gone down, but being the market down, the returns should be more. We should be offering them more lucrative deals to get their money out of the bank to our deals. So if they're getting 5% and we are offering them 6%, I have seen some deals where the preferred return is 6% or 7% is most common, but some 6 or 5% also. Why would somebody move their money from the bank to the deal when you are not paying them like 8, 9, 10%?
Well, you know, and I can answer that question. It's all a function of your revenue, right? And your cap rate and your financing. So we've also seen rental rates cool. So people are saying, why aren't, I've got a deal right now in San Antonio. And people are like, well, you know, the average cash on cash, I think 6.5%, the average IRR is 16 or 17, and you will double their money in 5 years. But, you know, if you underwrote that deal in 2022 and you saw the growth of rent from 2022 and backwards, you might have a different perspective, where today we've seen that rent dive off or drop off and cool down. So thus my future projections are not going to be as aggressive. And then also coming into, you know, where the interest rates are at. So if you're buying a six cap and you're getting interest rates at a 5.5 cap, there's positive arbitrage there. That's good. But the distance between that positive arbitrage hasn't gone up. So it's not like you're getting interest rates at 4.5 and you're buying, you know, back in 2014, 2015, 2016, you saw a bigger spread in between those interest rates and where your cap rates were. Now, that was because there was less people in the space, but now there's more people in the space. Correct. And my opinion to all of that is that your arbitrage hasn't changed. So when you're buying in 2021 or 2022, you might have bought where a cap rate's at a 4 or 4.5 and interest rates might have been 3.75. Well, today you're buying at 5.5 cap rates or 6 cap rates and interest rates are 5.5 or 6, depending if you get, you know, treasuries. So the delta between the two has remained relatively the same when you look at it on an absolute basis. That's where, you know, you will have the same, and if you had the same growth on both options and the same exit expansion on cap rates, you're probably going to reap the same type of investor returns. But if you're comparing to, say, something back in 2014 where you are buying at a bit larger spread, that will then justify saying, well, here's 7 or 8 or 9 or 10% cash flow rather than 5, 6 or 7. So I just want to very clarify that for the listeners, because what KK is saying is important, but you have to understand the spread between where interest rates are and where cap rates are at.
So what I'm trying to say is that the interest, just as that interest rate went up, the cap rate didn't go proportionately up, which it should have, but it didn't go proportionately up. It's some I have seen some deals they're buying at the same cap rate as this interest rate or even less.
Right. Well, so to that, and that's a very good point, there's a flaw that I think you're seeing to establish, right? Because a lot of people, so again, you got to understand where the lens in which you're looking from. And I was operating in 2014. We were buying deals where you're buying the mid 5 caps and you're buying interest rates in the mid 4 caps. So it was about 100 basis point spread. It was around that. And this is better quality deals. This is not more marginal deals. You also have to understand where the and I'm going to stuff this up. Is it the nominal rate or the absolute inflation? So where you take inflation from interest rate. So for example, today inflation, let's say, is 3%, but the Fed rate is 5.5. So your nominal rate is the delta between the two, right? So just call it 2.5%. But if you're buying cap rates at 5.5%, there's still a big spread there. And that's where people are still flocking to and seeing that spread occur, not necessarily between the going in cap rate and interest rates, but where the nominal interest rate is in comparison to inflation. And there's still a spread there of about 250 basis points in today's market. And if you look through history, there's roughly a 250 basis point spread between those nominal interest rates versus cap rates today. I also think there's just a time of people have spent so much time on the sidelines over the last 18 months, they've got a hole to burn in their pocket. And I don't think you're going to see interest rates, sorry, cap rates of multifamily expand any further. I think, you know, for 80s vintage product, you're in the sort of high fives, maybe low sixes. For 70 vintage product, you're probably in the mid sixes. For newer vintage product, which I've seen trade in Texas and even in Indianapolis, in the high fours, low fives. So they're going in with negative arbitrage, but their spread on nominal interest rates are still healthy, and thus, depending on your investment thesis, is that, well, I'm still parking my money in a physical asset with fixed rate debt, and I'm still getting a positive over the nominal, I then, you know, that's a good investment in some people's eyes. So I've said a lot there, and I want you to comment on that, but you know, just to educate the listener about the differences of, say, 2014 versus today, and trying to break it down a little bit better to really understand why some things haven't changed, but some things have.
So another thing I have noticed over these years is that the spread between A class, B class, and C class, it has also shrinked a lot.
Correct.
So sometimes when I started like 8-9 years ago investing, C class used to be like at least 1.5 or even not
2% higher.
So 2% higher between the classes. 1.5 to 2% higher. But nowadays, the cap rate is same for all classes of the properties. So a lot of people are avoiding the C-class properties, going directly to B-class properties.
Yep, agreed. I will say that if we have seen on our underwriting, like a market like Phoenix, for example, we did see certain markets, Phoenix being one of them, Austin being another one. Well, Austin not so much, but definitely Phoenix, where as interest rates started to increase, and to your point, you know, there was a very narrowing gap, particularly when interest rates were close to zero, where a class C would have traded at like a, you know, call it a 4.5 cap, and a class A would have traded at a high 3 cap. It wasn't a lot of spread. But then when the interest rates started to expand, those class C assets expanded in lockstep. So I did see, you know, a lot of people trying to price their assets at a 4.5 cap when interest rates were, you know, in the high fours, and you wanted that positive spread. So you're saying, no, I'm only going to pay a 5.5. And I do see certain markets, back to my point earlier, of like class A's trading, you know, true class A's probably trading in that 4.75 to 5 handle, depend, you know, in good markets across the US, Sunbelt markets as well. Class B, 80s product or newer, probably high mid to high fives, and then class C is probably, you know, 6 and above. So there is, starting back to probably what you're saying, KK, yeah, of that 100 to 150 basis points is occurring in today's market. I definitely am seeing in the deals that we're buying today.
That's so good.
Yeah, it's good, but it's also about making sure that when we now at RSN, we keep underwriting deals to keep an eye on the market in terms of real-time data and all the markets we're across. Because if we wait for CoStar, if we wait for Asymmetrics, and if deals aren't trading, then you're not getting any real-time data. Like I saw a graph on CoStar saying, you know, Class C product is trading for, you know, 525. Well, that was incorrect, because we're picking stuff up at 6 caps in real time. So it's just like waiting for data to sometimes be published by these big groups is good, but you also have to have your own data as a syndicator, as an operator, to keep your finger on the pulse. I think is really, really important to understand true value. But anyway, I don't want to.
CoStar data is normally a year behind.
That's right. Exactly. Yep. That's exactly right. Well, KK, as we wrap up the show here, what's your plans for 2024 and beyond? Are you still wanting to buy multi? Are you going to start buying more laundromats? Are you going to do something completely different and buy a plumbing company?
No, I'm not buying any other businesses other than what we have. So we do have plans for buy more laundromats or building more laundromats, because my son, he graduated from Kellogg School of Business, and he has taken over what I used to do. So he's managing all those businesses. And I'm still into multifamily, and I'm thinking of forming a fund. I might diversify into other asset classes a little bit.
That's awesome.
I still love multifamily, and but everybody is in the fund to diversify. So I'm thinking of also diversifying my investments into different asset classes.
You might be starting a laundromat fund, my friend, syndicating bunch of laundromats. Yeah, no, I joke. I think you should, because if you've got that experience, or even
I had that idea. I can't do that in Fort Wayne, but I might expand to Indianapolis and build some really good large laundromats. And I might. And a lot of people, when I bought these three laundromats last year, I did a 1031 exchange. A lot of my investors reached out to me to invest in these laundromats.
Yeah, no, I could imagine, because the cap rates on laundromats, talking about cap rates, for example, like you buying a business, and I'm not going to get into business valuations, but we've been looking at it. You know, they talk about EBITDA multiples, and we're not, again, I'm not going to try to get into it for the listeners, but typically you're in the 3 to 4 multiple range, right?
Correct.
So on 100%, that's a 25% cap rate, right? If you're buying on a 4 multiple. So if you're buying a laundromat business at a 4 multiple, so if it says it does $1 million in EBITDA, you'd be buying it at $4 million. That's a 25% cap rate. Compare that to multifamily, where you're still buying in the 5 cap rates. Now, if you get some leverage on the business on a laundromat, you know, there's a massive spread there. So you're cash flowing so much more, because, again, back to that arbitrage we were talking about earlier, if you're buying at a 25 cap versus interest rates, even if interest rates are 10 on an SBA loan, that's a 15% spread. That's huge. Like, you're going to cash flow. So,
I mean, our laundromats, when we renovated and started back in April, they started cash flowing day one.
Yep. Well, mate, I don't know what you're doing in multifamily with these tight spreads. Go get a fund. And,
but there is saturation in this market. Laundromat.
Sure.
So I can, if I go build another one here in Fort Wayne, that's going to bring my customers from other laundromats to my laundromat. But I'm thinking of expanding to Indianapolis. We looked at a few properties there as well. So at that time, I might do a syndication and open like 5 of them.
Yeah. No, look, I think the, you know, as a layman, I'm not a laundromat expert, but I assume you got to look at, really dive into that 1 mile radius demographic. Like, how many people are renting? What's the income? I remember used to going to laundromat when I lived in New York City. I wasn't going any more than 4 blocks away. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to go drive 5 miles out of my way for a laundromat. So,
times have changed. Times have changed. Now laundromats are like 5-star hotels.
Yeah. Yep.
So those laundromats you could put for $100,000, when what you are talking about. But nowadays, I mean, it takes $1.5 million to put a laundromat. It's not that common. And a lot of the older laundromats are going out of business because they can't afford to update them to the level where the new ones are. That's what brought me into this business, because when I built that one, there was none here in Fort Wayne. Fort Wayne has 300,000 people, so there was none here like the one we built.
Yeah.
So people were traveling 5 to 10 miles.
Wow.
To our laundromat.
Well, I think you got an insider there, mate. Like, you've already built the concept. I think go keep building the rest of the ship. So I'll be interested. Let me keep you on your email list, and I'm sure people will reach out to you as you launch. Get your son to do all the hard work. It sounds like you're coming towards the end of your working career, and you don't want to do going and,
and
raising another fund.
He's doing a better job than I did, because I did it the old style, old school way. And he's doing everything since he went to a business school. So he's doing everything. He's getting coaching and all that. I never got the coaching to do any business. So he's doing a much better job than I am.
That's awesome. Well, KK, look, at the end of the show, just wanted to ask, where can people reach you to continue the conversation?
Well, they can go to growrichcapital.com and sign up a form. Or they can directly reach out to me at kk@growrichcapital.com.
Awesome, my friend. Well, I just want to thank you so much for jumping on today's show. I think it's a incredible wealth of knowledge that you bring to the table across so many different diverse business backgrounds. But I do really love what you said earlier, that all the businesses, the common theme that you have seen is the type of tenants that, you know, tenants, customers, whatever, however you want to, people who frequent the laundromats, the petrol stations, the, you know, the rental housing, they're all the same. They have similar habits, and trying to manage those habits as you come in as a new owner is challenging for everyone. I know as myself buying C plus, B minus assets, you know, it's always you're trying to bring in better property management, better, you know, systems, and trying to break the old habits, right? And old habits die hard. But I think in general, identifying that as the common thread, that at the end of the day, we're all humans, right? We've got to connect with our tenants and our customers at the same way. And, you know, they all want to get good value for money. They all want to, you know, pretend like, not pretend, but all want to be heard. And it's a great way to approach business, because once you bring it down, business is a management of not only the managing your employees, but in managing your staff, managing your tenants, and managing your customers. And you can do all that very, very successfully. You could probably go into any business and have a really successful and fruitful career. In that summary, did you leave anything out there?
I think I always say in the end, when you try to invest in these multifamily or wherever you do, invest in yourself before you invest in any real estate or any other business.
Thanks again, KK, for jumping on the show. Remember, enjoy the weekend, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
Thank you very much for having me, Reed. It's my pleasure to be on the show.
Well, there you have it. Another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible advice from KK. Remember, if you want to find out anything where he is at, it's Grow Rich Capital. Google Grow Rich Capital. You can Google KK Singh. It's KAYKAYSINGH. Is that correct, KK?
Correct.
And make sure you're checking out what he's doing over there. And if you're interested in his laundromat business, I'm going to be the one here first to tell you that I bet you I'm going to put money on it. He's going to start a fund, I reckon, one day. So you'll hear it first on Investing in the US, and KK can thank me later for all the people who want to go and invest and keep going and investing in good people like yourself, KK. So to all those listeners out there, thank you so much for taking some time out of the day to continue to grow your financial IQ. We've been doing this podcast for nearly a decade. It's been crazy to say we've been going for nearly a decade. So the easiest way to give back to me, we don't make any money out of this show. We do it purely for the love of educating you guys. Go give it a 5-star review on iTunes. If you've got friends that are wanting to listen to it, tell them to subscribe, because that's help us keep the doors open and keep producing awesome content week in, week out. And again, we're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.